Welcome to From Today. In this podcast series, we aim to bring Erich Fromm's humanism and social psychology to life for the present. How can Fromm's thinking help us to face the social challenges of our time? In the podcast, we talk to Fromm experts and other people of interest who explain and expand on Fromm's perspective and apply it to our time in the 21st century. Roger Free holds dual professorships in education and psychiatry at Simon Fraser University and the University of British Columbia. In December 2025, he will leave his home in Vancouver for a new job as Professor of Psychoanalysis at the University of Vienna. One of the world's leading authorities on Erich Fromm, Roger is the author of the 2024 book Edge of Catastrophe, Erich Fromm, Fascism and the Holocaust. I talk to him about the book, but also about Fromm's legacy for our own time.
Thank you so much, Roger, for taking the time. I know it's early morning in Vancouver. Sorry about that. It's late in the afternoon here in Germany, but very pleased to have the chance to talk to you over the next hour or so about your most recent book on Fromm, Edge of Catastrophe, Erich Fromm, Fascism and the Holocaust. Perhaps we, as the conversation goes on, we can fan out and discuss some more general issues around Fromm and maybe his relevance for contemporary debates. But I wanted to begin with a passage from the book, actually from the beginning of chapter 4, Confronting Genocide, which I think in one paragraph offers a kind of overview of the book, and perhaps you can then you can react and pick out the bits that you think is most important. But I'll just read it because I think it situates what we're going to talk about as well as any other passage I was able to find in the book. In 1945, as the full extent of the catastrophe began to be revealed, Erich Fromm struggled to make sense of the darkness at the heart of fascism. He was reminded of a speech that was given by a fascist general, Mian Astray, in Spain that ended with the words, Viva la muerte, long live death. With that statement, Fromm wrote, one of the deepest emotional sources of fascist ideology has been touched upon. In the years and decades that followed, Fromm sought to understand the origins of the evil that spawned so much cruelty, suffering, and death. He returned again and again to the question of Germany and its responsibility for the Holocaust, leading him to important insights into the nature of racial narcissism and destructiveness. His interest in these issues was not just academic. It was also deeply personal. Fromm grieved the deaths of Gertrude, Sophie, and many other relatives, friends, and colleagues. The Holocaust correspondents and the knowledge of what they endured would form the unspoken context for many of Fromm's social and political writings. In the wake of the war and genocide, Fromm was strongly committed to building a just society that could secure the voice of all its citizens, regardless of background or identity. I think that encapsulates the book as a whole perfectly, but perhaps there's something you want to add to your own summary there.
Sure. First of all, thank you for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be able to speak about the book. I think my concern in writing the book was to reveal this history. It had been talked about briefly, and by this history, I mean the history of the Holocaust in Fromm's family. It had been talked about briefly by Rainer Funk in his intellectual biography of Fromm, which came out in 2018 and 19, and earlier briefly by Lawrence Friedman in his biography of Fromm, which came out around 2013. But the full nature, both of what happened to Fromm's family, as well as what Fromm himself experienced as a German Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany, to me seemed to be a chapter that had yet to be written. And this was particularly significant because to this day, I think one could argue that Fromm's most essential book is The Fear of Freedom. And it is this book that seeks directly to address both the nature and the threat of fascism in the form of National Socialism in Germany. And then later on, of course, we have The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, in 1973. And these two books in particular, I find could be thought about as bookending all of the works that Fromm has written during this period from 1941 right through 1977. The last book, of course, is To Have and To Be. And which country should To Have and To Be had the greatest impact on? Germany, West Germany in particular. And once one, I think, begins to learn the personal history of what Fromm endured and what his family went through and the trauma and tragedy that they experienced, then it gives these books in particular, I find, an entirely different light, right, through which one begins to encounter them. And the meaning of what Fromm writes is no longer just an intellectual
Academic,
argument,
yeah.
yeah, or academic. It is deeply personal. And I think the question I asked myself was, so is it that we until now have essentially not known that history? It has been talked about in small parts. There have been indications that this history exists, but there had been no book-length study to really try to delve into this history, to begin to come to terms with what it might have been like for Fromm, and in turn, how he may have reflected on that experience as he wrote these books.
I mean, one of the first things that surprised me about, well, surprised me, but that I was reminded of, I suppose, as I read the book, is that Fromm himself wasn't really a refugee at the beginning. I mean, or in any case, his passage to America may have been made swifter by the rise of Adolf Hitler. But Fromm, the cosmopolitan, I think, was very keen to go to the United States anyway, for earlier in his life, and had an opportunity perhaps to go. That his own position, you know, as a kind of cosmopolitan, I think Rainer Funk also talks about how even within Germany he was commuting between Munich and Heidelberg for many years. Obviously, Fromm's own kind of understanding of Judaism, very much that idea of a mobile homeland, Heine's old idea, and that he was very keen, I think, to travel anyway. Obviously, the events of 1933 led him to, I think it was 1934. You can maybe speak more about Fromm's arrival in the US. But that he wasn't a kind of refugee in the way that some of his relatives sought to be, and that he was trying to rescue people who were maybe quite different from him, people who weren't academics, just members of his own family that got stuck in the grind of the grinder of Nazi Germany. Yeah.
Yeah, so perhaps it would be helpful to readers just to give a few more details about this period of history in particular. And as I'm sure many listeners will know, Fromm was born in 1900 in Frankfurt and died in 1980 in southern Switzerland in the Tessin. And in 1931, Fromm was diagnosed with tuberculosis. And this diagnosis was in 1931 enormously serious, right? Many people with the diagnosis did not survive. Those who had the means went to Switzerland, to Davos in particular, to experience a cool. So they were essentially in the High Alps, and this helped alleviate their symptoms. And the hope was always that they might, over time, get better. So he, in 1931, went to Davos, and in the period from 1931 through 1933, he had ongoing tuberculosis. There were times where it would get better again and then worse. And then, of course, in January of 1933, the Nazi Party was elected to power for the first time, and they were fully elected to power in March of 1933. At which point Fromm's life was threatened, right? Being Jewish, being Marxist, and being a psychoanalyst was not a trifecta that you wanted to have. And so he essentially could not return to Germany at that point. And from that point onwards, he, in essence, became a refugee. He didn't define himself that way. But he could not return to Germany, or if he did return to Germany, he would be imperiled. And he had contacts to the United States, in particular Karen Horney, who had left for the United States and whom he knew from Berlin, who had left for the United States in 1932, had written an affidavit on behalf of Erich Fromm. And that enabled him in mid-1934 to get passage on board a ship to New York City. That in itself was a journey that took some 2 to 3 weeks from Switzerland to New York. And Fromm, even at that time in 1934, was very fortunate to receive passage on that ship, since many refugees were not admitted. And it was increasingly difficult to be admitted to receive a visa to the United States or indeed to other countries. I'm speaking to you from Canada. Canada, as it happened during the entire period of 1933 to 1945, admitted only 2,500 European Jewish refugees. That to give you just a measure of how difficult it was to escape Europe. Fromm did not write about his personal experience of this period. And what we know is through the letters that he wrote during this time, what we know is through the experience of others who were in his immediate circle and his immediate umkreis. And this gives us a sort of a look in into his experiences of the time. And I think one of the reasons that it has been difficult to write about this chapter is because Fromm himself didn't talk about what he went through. So we generally know that he arrived in the United States somewhere around the mid-1930s. He became established there and lived there through 1950, whereupon he moved to Mexico City. This is sort of the general overview. What we don't know so much about, and what I have sought and endeavored to share in the book, is what he actually experienced at a personal level during this period. And those experiences were both his own, but they were experiences that were revealed through the letters, that through the correspondence he had with his relatives who were unable to escape Germany and who were eventually deported and murdered in the Holocaust. These experiences were also revealed in his second marriage to Henny Gerland. And we can talk about that in some detail because I think it's a very important, often overlooked chapter. That marriage too ended tragically with her death. And she had escaped with Walter Benjamin. We can go back there over the Pyrenees. So again, all of these personal experiences cumulatively really give us a sense of who he was, not as an exile, but as a German Jewish refugee. And it was very important for me to make that point. And I think we're not used to associating that term with Erich Fromm, perhaps because of the post-war success that he had and his fame as a public intellectual. And yet it very much does, this experience and this identity very much does shape him. And I think what he writes about and what he does in the post-war decades.
I mean, you mentioned the Walter Benjamin episode with Henny, his second wife. Obviously, she was accompanying Benjamin. It's one of the, to me, it's one of the two sort of most dramatic suicides of, or literary suicides of the war. I suppose one is Stefan Zweig in Brazil, and the other one is Walter Benjamin. Fromm's second wife, Henny, was right there when Benjamin committed suicide on the French-Spanish border in 1940. I mean, as you say, Fromm is not really seen as a victim of history. He was so successful later in his life. He sold millions and millions of copies. He was a very successful professional, but obviously those years, those beginning in the early mid-1930s, as you said, he battled with the life-threatening health issues. He was effectively a refugee, even as I perhaps suggested that in his heart, as a cosmopolitan, it wasn't such a sort of hard to explain, isn't it? Would he I mean, what would he have done if the Nazis hadn't, maybe do a bit of counterfactual history? Where would Fromm have gone? Would he have gone back to Germany in 1934 if he'd healed from his tuberculosis, or would he have wanted to go somewhere else? Maybe that's a question for the counterfactual historians. But as you say,
It's an
the
important question.
yes.
I think it's a relevant question and one we can and probably should think about.
Do you think you have an answer? I mean, do you?
Well, based on my own research, I think it's important to understand that Fromm was very much on an upward trajectory within the German intellectual milieu. He had entered into psychoanalytic training at the Berlin Institute, and completed that in 1930. So he lived the last years of the 1920s in Berlin. The Berlin Institute at the time was recognized widely as the premier psychoanalytic institute. It was a progressive institute where many of the psychoanalysts were members of the Social Democratic Party, some were members of the Communist Party. Fromm himself was a member of what was called the Children's Seminar. It was called the Children's Seminar because most of its members were younger. All of those members were active in left-wing politics and sought to create a bridge between psychoanalytic practice and left-wing politics. And in 1929 and 1930, he was going back and forth between Frankfurt and Berlin. He became acquainted with Max Horkheimer, who, as we know, hired Fromm as the director of psychoanalysis and social psychology of the Institute for Social Research, which had just recently been set up in Frankfurt. And within the same building, Fromm was a co-founder and co-director of the new Frankfurt Institute of Psychoanalysis. And Fromm actually founded a low-cost clinic at the Institute for students and for factory workers, which was modeled on the Institute clinic that existed in Berlin. Also, embedded in the sets of progressive values of Weimar Berlin at the time. And if you look at all of those indicators, were it not for the rise of the Nazi Party and the rise of their virulent anti-Semitism, it is highly likely that both the Institute for Social Research and Fromm himself would have remained in Germany and would have continued his upward trajectory within that German academic and intellectual milieu that he had established himself in. And I think that too is important because Fromm didn't just give up sense of his culture and the language in which he was raised. He gave up a burgeoning career, and above all, he left his family behind. And some of the biographical that work that has been done mentions the books that Fromm left behind. But in fact, he never saw many of his family members again from 1933 onwards because he could not go back and because he then had to flee.
Was there any attempt by him? I mean, obviously he made the decision to go to the United States, I'm assuming fairly quickly at the end, but was it logistically possible, conceivable that he could have taken family members with him at the start, or was he kind of stuck on his own in Switzerland and forced to flee by himself?
That's a good question. I think, again, one has to remember why he was in Switzerland. I mean, we could actually say it was as a result of his tuberculosis that he found himself in Switzerland. He hadn't flown there from the Nazis, right? He was there when they were elected. And that it's sort of paradoxical to use this word, of course, but he was quite fortunate. Because, of course, the Swiss very quickly put up barriers to admitting refugees as well. And there's every indication to suggest that he hoped to remain in Switzerland. And one needs to remember that in 1932, Max Horkheimer, essentially reading the writing on the wall, had moved the Frankfurt Institute for Social Research from Frankfurt to Geneva. So from the period of 1932 through the mid-1930s, the Institute for Social Research was based in Geneva and not in Frankfurt. And during the periods in which Fromm was recuperating from tuberculosis and able to work, he would essentially be traveling by train from Davos to Geneva to the Institute.
Why did he then, what were the, maybe it's explained a little bit in the book, but if you can explain it in detail for our listeners, why did he then decide to leave Switzerland?
Because he wasn't able to stay. There were, if you can imagine, Switzerland was abutting Germany, and there were a tremendous number of refugees seeking entrance to Switzerland and seeking to remain in Switzerland. And only a small number of those refugees were actually permitted and given visas by the Swiss government. They were fearful that, they would essentially be overrun. Of course, it was questionable whether that was the case, and there are all sorts of things we could go into about the nature of the refugees and whether they wanted them to enter into Switzerland. Certainly, they were happy to take their money, as we know, but he couldn't remain in Switzerland. And he was fortunate enough that he received a visa through the help of Karen Horney in New York while she was in Chicago and then in New York.
And I guess the next counterfactual question you could ask is, well, if he hadn't got that visa, where would he have gone then? If he couldn't go back to Germany, he couldn't stay in Switzerland, he couldn't go to the US. Any thoughts there?
Right. Well, that's, I think, where the letters are very, very instructive. And I think we can probably talk about them now.
For sure, yeah.
But the letters essentially have to do with two aunts. Let me provide again listeners with a little bit of background. Fromm's father was from a very small family. And we haven't much information about that family, but we do know that many were able to escape Germany. Fromm's cousin, who was of like age and who was the daughter of Fromm's father's brother, actually moved to Zurich and got married in Zurich. So there was a connection. And this cousin remained the closest family member to Fromm throughout his life. And so there was this connection to Switzerland through his cousin. But most of the family members were on his mother's side. And his mother was from Berlin, from an established German Jewish family. And she had five siblings. And most of the letters that we have in the archives, and the letters are both housed in Tübingen, at the archive, at the Fromm Archive, and in the New York Public Library in Manhattan. And most of these letters are written by members of Fromm's mother's family. And Fromm was very close with his mother's family, I think in part because she missed them a great deal. She moved to Frankfurt from Berlin when she married his father. And so as a child, he would frequently go to Berlin and live there with his relatives. And so Berlin also became a part of his life, even though he grew up in Frankfurt from a very early age. He would often be there. And of course, later on, he lived there for, during this sort of heady period of the late 1920s. And these two aunts in particular, Sophie Englander, to begin with, sought to escape Berlin. Right? This is on the one hand. And on the other hand, we have another one of his aunts who was a little bit more distant, but her name is Gertrud Brandt. And she lived in the formerly German city of Posen, which is now part of Poznan, which is now part of Poland. And they were part of the German-speaking community there. And the letters were to the two of them. And what these letters reveal is the many ways in which Fromm sought to rescue them during the late 1930s. And these letters are sort of a constant during the latter 1930s into the early 1940s. And they really trace the emergence of the Holocaust right through the point at which, as I mentioned before, they were deported and then murdered. And one of Fromm's cousins was a man by the name of Heinz Brandt, who became quite well known in post-war West Germany, as an activist, as a humanist, as an anti-nuclear protester, and above all, as a communist. And Heinz Brandt, the Nazis had essentially found Heinz Brandt distributing flyers for the Communist Party in the early 1930s and had imprisoned him for a period of 6 years. And his mother, Sophie, reached out to Eric in the hope that Eric might be able to help Heinz get a visa in any other country other than Germany. And what this chapter in particular shows is the plight of so many German Jews who sought to escape Germany. They may have wished to go to a particular destination. The primary destinations were the United States and Palestine, but in fact, they were happy if they could find any destination
Anywhere.
which would admit them, right? And that's an important point. So, in answer to the question you asked some time ago about where Fromm may have gone, we can't answer that. But the best way you could answer that is the question would have been, where might he have received a visa? Right. So you have by the end of the Holocaust, you have a community of some 18,000 German Jews living in Shanghai.
Shanghai, yeah.
Right. And then, of course,
China.
throughout South
South
America.
America, Paraguay, yeah, of course, Argentina.
Exactly.
Yeah, he could have
Exactly.
ended. I mean, I suppose he. I mean, what if he hadn't got a visa anywhere? What would the Swiss authorities have done with him? They would have sent him back to Nazi Germany, I assume.
Possibly, or he may have been lucky enough to be able to wait there until he received a visa. One doesn't know.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's certainly yeah, it's a stark reminder of how like the serendipity of passage when you whether it's the Syrian Civil War or you go back up, 80 years to Nazi Germany, I mean that you had the idea of the Nansen passport after the First World War, which seemed like such a good idea to give, millions of people a chance to how can you relocate millions of people? But the world doesn't seem to have seized on that idea. There have been, dozens of other scenarios since 1944 or since 1933, I suppose, that where history's sadly repeated itself. Maybe we can talk a little bit about, well, as you say, the letters reveal Fromm's efforts. Is there any indication of survivor guilt, do you think, in the letters when he's very personally, that when 1945 has come and gone, and he's lost some of his family members to the Holocaust? Do you find any evidence of that? Do you think that I mean, it's obviously, I mean, this topic of his family suffering is I guess the book shows, is the elephant in the room of Fromm scholarship, right? It's like, and if it's the key to understanding Fromm's entire oeuvre, is like, why would he devote his energy to questions of fascism, populism, and human destructiveness if he hadn't been through such a terrible experience in his own? I mean, obviously, he was interested in certain themes around Marxist-related themes. Obviously, he was doing research on Weimar, the mentality of Weimar workers before the Nazis came to power, even so. But of course, the experience of the Holocaust and his family's experience must only have accelerated it. But was there, I mean, in the letters, do you have a sense of a person who is suffering from survivor guilt, or does he really keep that to himself?
Fromm was a famously private person, right? Quite a number of people who knew him have described that. I was able to interview three individuals who knew Fromm personally, all as trainees and assistants, Rainer Funk, of course, being one of them. None of them ever heard Fromm speak about the Holocaust, or indeed speak about his experiences of the time. And I think that is in itself quite revealing. For Fromm, this was, I would imagine, immensely personal, but also immensely painful. What we do know is that Einar Funk, upon Fromm's death, went through his personal belongings in Murano in southern Switzerland. And in a box, he found some of these letters from Sophie Englander, letters that were written to her daughter, Eva Kaus, in South America, in which Fromm is mentioned and Fromm's mother is mentioned. It appears that Fromm's mother was really a favorite amongst the sisters. And she thanks Fromm for his efforts in this letter, and she asks her daughter to send her warmest greetings, both to Fromm and to Fromm's mother. And this was the second last letter she ever wrote. And so Fromm kept this letter from the period of the Second World War and the Holocaust, through his move to Mexico City, through his 20 years there, moving there, and then through his move to Switzerland. He had kept this with his most precious belongings. And I think just that fact alone, I think, speaks volumes about the meaning of what took place in his life. As to whether he experienced any survivor guilt, we simply can't say with any certainty. It's hard to imagine from what we know of other German Jewish refugees who have written about their experiences that he did not, right? He was one of those, and again, I'm using this term paradoxically, but who was lucky enough to escape. And the reason that he became so central in the efforts of his family members to escape the Nazis was because Fromm was one of the only members in the family who had an established income abroad, right? And this meant that many of his closest family members put their hope in him that he might, in some way, be able to help. Because I think one easily forgets that early on, after the Nazis were elected to power, they sought to foster the emigration of the German Jewish community. And so they actually actively had people go to Palestine, Nazi members go to Palestine to arrange for emigration to that location, but also to others. But as time went on, and certainly after the November pogrom of November 9th, 1938, it quickly changed. And each year, the cost of the visa to leave Germany became greater, to the point at which people needed to sell everything they had, at prices that were far, far below the value of their property. They were essentially robbed blind. And then, if they were lucky enough, they were able to be granted a visa to leave, but they also needed another visa to get into a different country. And so I'm just sharing all of this because it's worth reflecting on the history of this and just how perilous, right? What a perilous situation they found themselves in, and Fromm as well. And I think, again, because we look back at Fromm as this famous public intellectual, we overlook this virtually an entire decade in his life in
Yeah,
which,
just utter precarity, yeah.
yes, a complete uncertainty, both in terms of health and in terms of location and safety.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrifying responsibility, especially when, I mean, direct family members you can just about cope with, but all of the aunts and uncles and cousins and second cousins that, any feeling person would want to help. And, he's working, living and working in the United States, trying to do his best for a broad circle of people. And as the circumstances get harder and harder, I mean, psychologically, it's a very difficult situation to be in, to carry that kind of responsibility, very concrete responsibility for, a specific but also kind of endlessly large community of people from which he kind of emanated. So, yeah, I mean, you can certainly see how that generation so famously just stayed quiet about it, for so, not wanting to talk about some of the more difficult and painful challenges of that time. I thought I might ask you a slightly more personal question. You describe in the book how your own background is obviously a descendant of not of the German Jewish population, but of the German population that served in the Nazi regime. Maybe you can say a word about how you came to this topic of research, because as Fromm came to it from, I guess, the victim side, you come to it from not as having been a perpetrator yourself, but as having descended from people who were kind of implicated in the whole system. Yeah, maybe it might be interesting to hear how you kind of wound up in brief. I realize I'm not asking you to summarize your entire life, but in brief, how you kind of came to this subject and maybe some of the ethical challenges you faced writing about it from the perspective that you come from.
Sure. I think that's an important question, and it's something I also talk about in the book. With books, there's always the question of to what degree does one reveal one's own experience? And I think we were just talking about that in regard to Fromm, about whether he revealed his own experience. In this case, I felt a responsibility to share my own family history. Because I think to this day, given my family history, it's somewhat precarious to write about the experience of the victims of Nazi Germany when one has family members who were on the sides of the supporters and enablers and perpetrators. And so I, in the book, I share some of that history, and it's work that I've done previously and published previously as well. But it was, in fact, and here I'm just going to go back a little bit because I think it might be helpful. It was, in fact, this question that first led me to Fromm. I read history and philosophy as a student, as an undergraduate in London, the University of London. And I was interested specifically, I worked with a specialist on fascism as an undergraduate by the name of Frank Snowden. And I was interested in understanding the motivations of Germans of my grandparents' generation for supporting Hitler. And this is what actually led me first to read Escape from Freedom, or Fear of Freedom, as the book is named in many English parts of the world outside of the United States. And it was really an attempt to understand what may have motivated them. At that point, I didn't know the full history of my family. Both my parents are German, had emigrated from Germany. So I grew up largely in Canada and then in Switzerland. And it wasn't until later in life that I discovered that my grandfather was, in fact, who was a contemporary of Fromm, just a few years younger, had become a member of the Nazi Party and a participant in what was known as the National Socialist Car Club, in essence, right, which was an attempt to indoctrinate largely middle-class Germans into Nazi ideology. And this was a history that in my family, which tended to be center-left, was simply not talked about. It had been covered over with a blanket of silence. And I think for some of my older relatives, also a sense of shame. And so they silenced it. And I found out about this history quite by chance. And I think ever since, I have struggled to understand how it was that my grandfather, who I knew as a child, who I didn't just know as a dusty picture hanging on the wall, and who was an important person in my early life, I struggled to understand how he could have been motivated to join the Nazi Party. He wasn't an early joiner, but nor was he a late joiner. It was he applied in 1936. And then it turned out, once I did archival research, that in fact the history was even more complex than I had assumed, because the documentation indicated that he had originally, in the early 1920s, been either a Communist Party member or certainly affiliated with or sympathetic to the Communist Party, involved in left-wing causes in Berlin. And he was also in Berlin at the time that Fromm lived there and worked there. And so this seemed to me to be sort of an important parallel that I share, because of course, one of Fromm's strong interests was try to understand how it was that left-wing workers and middle-class Germans essentially did not stand up to the Nazis. Not only that, ended up enabling the Nazis either by their silence or by their active support. And my grandfather fit into that cohort, right? And so this was the early fascination. But my knowledge of from, I think, goes back even further, and it's worth mentioning that as a child, I would often go to Germany to spend time with my family, and all of my family was there and still lives there to this day. And I remember in the late 70s going, and I remember hearing my older relatives debating To Have or to Be, which was, a book that one saw on a great many bookshelves at that time. It was so well known, right? And I remember as a child thinking, who is this man, Erich Fromm, that people seem so fascinated with, right? And so there was a sense of growing up with him. He was also on the bookshelves of my parents. But it was the specific question that I sought to answer, and that I looked for answers from in Fromm's work.
I mean, as you say, you've had a long time connection with Germany, obviously through your family. You've been here, you've lived here, you've worked here, you've come and gone from Germany. You're moving to Austria at the end of the year, which is what they call the German-speaking world. I live in Germany. Obviously, I'm not German myself. I've had to learn, if we can talk about, I can talk about my family. My great grandfather actually served in the contemporary relevance. Served in the British Army in 1916, establishing the British Mandate in Palestine, which I think brings me to, and again, I had to go and really understand what that meant, why he was even there. It wasn't really explained to me by my own family. I sort of figured it out much later what he was doing there and why he was there. Had an interesting relationship with Zionism and with Israel. My own sort of very superficial academic interest in Fromm sort of centers on his own PhD thesis, which is from very early, from 1922, when he was a very young man, 22 years old, where he focuses on the Jewish law and basically comes to understand Judaism as a liberation of the individual. He particularly sees the idea of Shabbat, this one day a week where you take a break from the work of the tribe and you reflect on your own kind of personal relationship with God. That is the beginning of modern individualism to Fromm. I mean, he goes on and talks about how obviously Renaissance humanism and the combination of Greek and Christian and elements mediated via Arab translation and so on, how that leads to a reflowering of individualism in the modern West. But I think he traces it back to something, some flower within the Jewish tradition himself, out of which he came, even though he came from ultimately very secular Jewish roots as well. But Rainer Funke has also emphasized that while he was in Frankfurt, he was visiting the local rabbi on an almost daily basis and was very serious at a certain point in his life about understanding Jewish tradition. And as I said, he came to this understanding that what's important about the Jewish legacy is not the tribal element, not even the, it's actually the opposite of that. It's the pathway to a certain type of individualism, which is, I suppose, the opposite then of the fascism and the collapse into obedience that you describe partly in the book, and that Fromm spent his career kind of trying to diagnose as a psychologist and social scientist to try and work against, because he saw he experienced firsthand how dangerous it was, how millions of people were able to go along with things that they perhaps shouldn't. I have another quote, which is not from this book, but it's actually a passage that I took of yours from an article you wrote a few years ago, which I took as an epigraph for a book I've written on Fromm. I just want to read it, and because I think it, I've got a couple of questions we can talk more, hopefully, in the last few minutes about Fromm, Israel, contemporary issues, how other counterfactual questions around what would Fromm's position be on the current situation in Palestine. But I'll just read this quote, because I think it'll situate the final part of the discussion quite well. This is you again here. Fromm was particularly interested in demonstrating how society produces people who unconsciously adapt to meet society's economic needs, even though these may conflict with our emotional well-being. As Fromm would famously remark in a later work, It is the function of social character to shape the energies of the members of society in such a way that their behavior is not left to conscious decisions whether or not to follow the social pattern, but that people want to act as they have to act. The point for Fromm is that society is always at work in the person, so that the person exists only as a fundamentally social being. By virtue of our participation in society, we learn to contain thoughts and feelings that might otherwise challenge the status quo. In this way, we might say that society inscribes pathology into human relationships. And this is the key part. For Fromm, the goal of psychoanalysis was not simply to adapt to society's needs, but to embrace a more grounded and ethically centered stance. In essence, to live soundly against the stream. And I think that as I said, there's this spark in the Jewish tradition that Fromm identifies with. And I think that's kind of what he carries on as back to America from the Jewish tradition. So we've got this whole question then about obviously the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 and everything that's happened then in that part of the world since then. Maybe because it's of such contemporary relevance, we can talk a little bit about Fromm's relationship with the State of Israel, with Zionism, with Judaism, and then perhaps ultimately come to a conclusion about how he would see current events. It's a lot, sure. I know, but I feel like we probably have to go there.
In the present circumstances, it's not, I think, easy to go there, and yet it's essential, isn't it?
It is.
So I think, first of all, again, it's important to understand the history and to understand both who Fromm was, but also what his beliefs were. And there we, of course, have material on which we can draw. So, yes, on the one hand, Fromm grew up in an Orthodox, middle-class Orthodox household, as you've indicated, in Frankfurt. And Judaism was, Orthodox Judaism in particular, was an important part of his early life through the early 20s. But just as important was that when he became involved with Frieda von Reichmann, the two of them, she was also of an Orthodox background, decided to give up their Orthodoxy and essentially to develop and take on a secular humanist outlook. And so they no longer practiced Judaism as religion, though, of course, they identified as Jewish. And that's really a key point. During this period, as you've also indicated, Fromm's perspective on Zionism changed. He was, as a young man in his late teens and early 20s, a supporter of Zionism. But by his mid-20s, just as he began to take on a secular humanistic outlook, he also moved in his position towards Zionism from supporting it to actually being critical of it. And he maintained that critical position through the remainder of his life. And so, although he doesn't write a great deal about Palestine or indeed Israel, one does find throughout the decades that followed certain publications in which he makes his views known. And in the book, I sought to quote from these various publications, really beginning in the late 1940s and then through the 1970s, both in letters and publications for a broader audience, to just share with the reader what his views of Zionism were. And in a nutshell, though I can also perhaps read what he says, in a nutshell, he was very critical of the progressively more right-wing perspectives within Israel because of his fear of what the state of Israel would mean for the Arab population. And that he didn't use the term Palestinians, but he used the term Arabs to refer to the population that lived there and had lived there over many, many generations. And Really, this position became clear in 1948, and this part I think is worth sh sharing, in that Hannah Arendt contacted Fromm in 1948, and this was right at the point at which the State of Israel was first established, and there were quite a number of German Jewish intellectuals who were concerned about what the establishment of a state of Israel would mean, in essence, for the local population. And this concern had to do with the essential struggle, armed struggle that was already in existence between Jewish refugees who had arrived in Palestine and Palestinians who were living there. And this armed struggle was already going on for quite some time. You indicated your grandfather, and of
Under
course,
the watchful
Britain.
eyes of the British, yeah, at least
And
until
yeah,
1947, yeah.
right. And that's a whole further discussion. But in 1948, she contacted Fromm to, in essence, assess his backing for a public statement on the need for a binational state in Palestine. And Fromm was in agreement. And then he contacted a number of well-known German Jewish intellectuals. And in fact, in the end, he went through multiple drafts of writing up this statement. And we have a sense that he wrote this statement with others. Martin Buber was involved, Hannah Arendt was involved. And then they, in the end, had only two signatures, and those signatures were from Albert Einstein and Leo Beck, right? So huge names within the German Jewish
Not bad to have, yeah.
community. Yes, and it was published on April 18th, 1948. A full page was taken out in the New York Times, essentially calling for an end to what they refer to as the fanatical nationalism and terrorism on both sides, and the need for a binational state. And this need for a binational state was essentially Fromm's position from that point onwards.
I mean, I guess that brings us slowly or fairly quickly down to the present day. As I sit in Germany, we've just very current events. We've got European countries, including Germany, increasing calls for a recognition of a Palestinian state separate to Israel. In other words, for a kind of two-state solution. That's obviously something very different from the idea of a binational state. I mean, maybe we can talk a little bit about. And it's become very difficult in Germany to have a rational discussion on this topic for historical reasons related exactly to the material we're talking about. But the perhaps we can ask a counterfactual question, or we can think for a minute. How would Erich Fromm have how would he have reacted to events, let's say, since the 7th of October 2023? Would he, if we imagine him still alive and active as he was until his death in 1980, what I mean, it seems fairly obvious to me what position he would have taken, but maybe if you were in your summary, there might be something that I would that might surprise me and perhaps some of the listeners.
I wonder whether it might be helpful just to read something out, to actually
Absolutely.
quote
Do
from
it.
in this case.
Do it.
In 1970, he wrote a lengthy and quite revealing letter to the US Senator George McGovern. And he states in this letter the following: "As a Jew and one who is deeply rooted in the Jewish religious tradition, and who has all his life followed closely the development of Zionism, and since two decades of the State of Israel, I'm certainly not without sympathy for the Jewish plight and not without knowledge of the history of Zionism, which has led straight to the present situation. But at the same time, Fromm states, quote, the problem of the aggressive spirit which has existed in Israel since the foundation of the state, and before that in the leading figures of Zionism, must be called out. And then he goes on to expand on that, and I'll just read these last sentences. Psychologically speaking, The faith in force and the pride in successful application of force is very understandable. This is a reaction of a people who feel not only grieved, but also humiliated by the fact that Hitler could slaughter 6 million Jews. It is natural that they are tremendously sensitive to the dangers of being destroyed another time. But that this attitude is understandable is one thing. Its political consequences are another. As far as I can see, it has led to an intransigence which runs through the whole history of the state of Israel. So I think from that quote, one gets a sense very clearly from where Fromm stands on this. And Fromm was a very strong critic of nationalism and any form of ethno-nationalism.
Yeah.
And this very much influenced his stance. So I think, from this discussion, as you rightly point out, is so difficult at this point of time, at this point in time. And I think that was why it was important, perhaps not to hear from me, but to hear from directly in terms of what he says.
Yeah. I mean, you can speculate, I guess, someone who's been as 55 years old, the passage that you just read out, and in many ways, the situation hasn't changed a lot. I wrote a piece actually just before, it was May 2023, before the 7th of October, wrote a piece on Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, who actually was writing newspaper articles in 1970 exactly on the situation of Palestinians in Gaza specifically. And it was kind of unbelievable the extent to which 50 plus years of history have passed and the situation hasn't fundamentally changed, and the identity perhaps of the state of Israel hasn't fundamentally changed from Fromm's description of it in 1970, and Darwish's description is actually extremely similar to Fromm's description. What maybe has changed in that time is just the and there seems to be just a total lack of leadership on this issue globally. The binational state that seemed to make sense to secular humanist intellectuals on both sides, by the way, in the early years and decades, it seems as if nobody on either side really wants that anymore. And so it's very hard to know, with all of the history that's happened since his death in 1980, what exactly would Eric Fromm be advocating in 2025, in August 2025, as we sit here? Maybe fruitless to even speculate about what that might be. But perhaps we can talk, instead, if you prefer maybe not to speculate on that, maybe we can talk a bit more in detail about some of the, obviously, Fromm's own diagnoses of the kind of collective manias and hysterias that lead to fascism and that lead to desires for ethnic cleansing and so on, the sorts of things that we're arguably, not even arguably anymore, that we are actually witnessing in contemporary events in that part of the world.
Yes, I think that could be quite useful to really to turn it back to Fromm and what he actually says. In this case, I would turn to Fromm in the early 1960s. So let me preface what I say by pointing out that Fromm was really unique. I think we all understand that, but we often approach Fromm as a social theorist, as a public intellectual, as a social philosopher and psychologist. But it's easy to overlook that Fromm was, and I really emphasize this, first and foremost, a psychoanalyst, by which I mean, throughout these decades that we've been speaking about, Fromm had a daily psychoanalytic practice. He saw patients on a daily basis. And he would see patients, and then he would write. Right. And when we look at Fromm primarily as a writer, I think we forget this other side of who he was. And it's hard not to see, once one recognizes that Fromm's daily practice and his interaction with individuals who worked with him in his practice inevitably shaped his perceptions and his human sensibilities about who we are, about how we relate to one another, about our destructiveness, about issues of racism, and issues of hatred, if you will. And at the same time, he observed these things both within the context of his life and the trajectory of his family, but also going on around him at the time, contemporaneously. And so these two perspectives together merge, I think, into his writings. And I would argue that that's one of the reasons that his writings do have such a reach, why they were successful in reaching such a wide audience. Obviously, he was a gifted writer. He could write for a general audience, but there was also a very human element in what he said that I think stems from his work with individuals. And I'm saying all of this because Fromm was unique as a psychoanalyst in that most psychoanalysts, in fact, I would argue almost all psychoanalysts of his day, did not talk about politics, did not talk about society, did not talk about what happened outside of the therapeutic setting. And this is something you indicated earlier on, Jonathan, but for Fromm, one could not understand the individual without also understanding society. And the well-being of the individual is dependent on the well-being of society. And so if one, for example, and I'm speaking as a practicing psychoanalyst, though one trained in the Frommian tradition, if one works with someone around the issue of racism, it is also incumbent on the therapist, incumbent upon all of us, indeed, to recognize and to see and to know about racism in society. And so one of the things that Fromm did address, and I think very importantly in the early 1960s, was racism in the United States. And he did this at the height of the civil rights movement. And he specifically addressed group and racial narcissism amongst Southern whites in the United States. And he compared the dynamics that he perceived in the Southern United States with what he had experienced in Nazi Germany, and talked about the ways in which groups bond together and seek out a leader in whom they can invest themselves and have their narcissistic needs met. And this leader, Fromm argues, is him or herself best suited if they are themselves narcissistic in nature. And here I thought I would just read a single paragraph, and one which is, I think, very, very telling and prescient, and helps us perhaps to understand current circumstances. And so this is from 1964, and this is from Fromm's discussion of malignant and group narcissism. Fromm states as follows: "The highly narcissistic group is eager to have a leader with whom it can identify itself. The leader is then admired by the group, which projects its narcissism onto him. In the very act of submission to the powerful leader, which is in depth an act of symbiosis and identification, the narcissism of the individual is transferred onto the leader. The greater the leader, the greater the follower. Personalities who, as individuals, are particularly narcissistic are the most qualified to fulfill this function. The narcissism of the leader who is convinced of his greatness and who has no doubts is precisely what attracts the narcissism of those who submit to him. The half-insane leader is often the most successful one." So when you hear that, right, written in 1964, published in 1964, it's not too hard to think about certain leaders who have an authoritarian bent that we see
Indeed,
around
yeah.
us today. And these ideas themselves stem from the escape from freedom and Fromm's work in the 1930s, which he undertook in Germany before he left, and then afterwards in Switzerland. And here he really develops them within the American context.
Yeah, I
And
mean,
then later
I
on, sorry,
sorry.
go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
Or I was just going to say, and then later on, one revisits them in Anatomy of Human Destructiveness.
I was simply going to say that the revelation for me reading from, especially some of his earlier work on the night out of the 1930s on the authoritarian character, obviously social character changes over time, and Fromm mentions a lot about the modern marketing mentality and then the rise of narcissism, and they're not all one thing. They're all kind of slightly different things from each other, and they characterize different decades, different epochs. But this, the idea that the authoritarian character, the leader, is also someone who is a kind suffers from the same pathologies as the people who follow them, and that it's a very kind of quick inversion. That precisely the people who are, and you think about even some, I hate to say it, but somebody like Elon Musk, who is himself a kind of leader, perhaps as you said, with certain right-wing populist tendencies, that he was able to submit to somebody like Donald Trump so easily, at least for a period of time. Maybe it's to his credit that he eventually kind of snapped out of it or came out of it. But that you wouldn't, you would order in an ordinary, an ordinary person would think, well, certain people kind of have dominant personalities and that's why they become leaders, and other people have, I guess, weaker personalities and that's why they turn into sheep and follow the leaders around. But in fact, as Fromm reveals, it's a lot more complicated than that. That you have a dynamic where a certain type of person, who might be also be tending to have a more slavish type character, could very well find themselves in charge. I mean, one thinks perhaps of whether that applies to Stalin or not. I don't know. I wouldn't like to say. But for someone from outside psychoanalysis to kind of have Fromm's perspective on that sort of changes the way you think about authoritarianism, or perhaps even about fascism, and this idea that it's a strong leader, that in fact, you know,
Yeah.
the personality of the leader can be just as brittle as the people following them, if not more so. And perhaps, you know,
Right.
whether you see that with somebody like Donald Trump ultimately, I guess, is a question that can be debated forever. But yeah, it's all too relevant for contemporary debates, whether we look at really whichever continent we want to look at, whether it's India, Europe, Turkey, the United States, wherever you look, there seem to be authoritarian leaders taking advantage of populations who are maybe a little bit too willing to submit to them. I mean, you even call it, one of your chapters is titled "Yearning to Submit," as a kind
Yeah.
of part of the pathology of we'll call it populism, or perhaps even of fascism, as your subtitle directly comes out and calls it. I thought perhaps we've got, I mean, we probably have another 10 or 15 minutes left if we want them. You mentioned obviously that, like Erich Fromm, you are a practicing psychoanalyst yourself, and that your days, probably like Fromm's, are divided between practice and then writing, and I guess a fair bit of teaching with your university roles. Do you, I mean, I guess it's obvious you will say that it's an enrichment of your, that they mutually enrich each other, these different aspects of your life. But is there anything you kind of want to share about your own, and relevant to maybe what we've talked about so far, but your own experience as a psychoanalyst? I mean, you mentioned perhaps you've worked with clients specifically on the issue of racism. How does that play out in a clinical psychoanalytic setting?
It's a good question, an important one, also a big one. I can attempt to answer that. If I were to look at it from a Frommian perspective or through a Frommian lens, I think the key point would be that the clinician, in this case myself, that I see myself as a member of society and not existing as separate from society. And this, of course, was Fromm's point already from the early 1930s, as you know. And that what happens in society, the forces of society inevitably also shape me as a clinician. And so they shape me in terms of what I'm able to see, but also, very importantly, they shape me in ways that mean that I'm blind to certain sets of experiences, right? So I, as a, an older white man in his 50s, inevitably living in a society like Canada, have certain privileges that come with that identity, whether I want them or not. They are there. And what that can mean is that I can also be blind to and unaware of the realities of racism and the realities of discrimination and inequality as they exist in our society. And I'm sharing this just to give an indication of the way that Fromm emphasized that society is in the room in the clinical work, right? We cannot assume that if we have an office setting and shut the doors, we leave society outside, right? The forces of society are always shaping what we hear, but also very importantly, what we don't hear. And so too, the process of healing doesn't just happen in the room, it happens in society. And if we are talking about racism, for example, or discrimination, we may begin to understand its nature and its impact within the clinical therapeutic setting and be able to talk about it. But that doesn't mean it doesn't continue to exist outside of the clinical setting, right? And so it is incumbent upon the clinician not only to be aware of how society shapes what happens within the therapeutic realm, but also to address what happens in society as a whole. So Fromm believed fervently that clinicians need to be educated in politics, in economics, in sociology, in ethics. And he argued, along with his fellow like-minded psychoanalysts here, I'm meaning in particular Harry Stack Sullivan and others, that in the training of clinicians, psychoanalysts in particular, it was essential that they have coursework in these areas. Right? So it was really quite a radical perspective, right, in comparison to mainstream clinical work of the period. And although Fromm doesn't write to any great lengths about clinical work per se, one finds again and again, I think, the sensitivities of the clinician in his writings. Of course, in particular, in his writings about the nature of love and loving and relating to others and human solidarity. I think all of which can be traced back and are related to his clinical work and really form a counterpoint to his discussions of human destructiveness and human hatred, right? As ways of, in essence, seeking to balance those perspectives.
I mean, it's an older model. I guess you could trace it back to the figure of the rabbi, if you wanted to, in the Jewish tradition, and probably in other traditions, we have similar sort of figures of general humanistic authority. You know, people, well-read people to whom you take your problems, who help you to solve them, and that the idea that you can replace all of that wisdom, all of that knowledge of history and literature, and different cultures, languages, and so on, that understanding of politics. The idea that you can replace that with kind of modern scientific or pseudoscientific knowledge, and you can medicalize the whole thing. There's obviously there's a lot more going on that people need, especially people who are struggling with specific issues. It's often because of a lack of access to that kind of education themselves, and so they having someone who they can talk to about, or someone who's able to talk about all of these different aspects of society, is as much a part of the clinical work as any kind of formal modern diagnosis or decisions about therapy or even things like medication or whatever. So it sort of makes sense that you would see that societies need that they're a real kind of leadership based not on sort of narcissism or following blindly what the authority says, but that from, in a way, I guess, understood the role of the clinician similar perhaps to the role of the rabbi, and not as the role of the doctor to whom, the offering an impartial judgment, that to one to which the ignorant masses simply had to submit. I think he probably, I'm sure I've seen passages in Fromm where he intimates how important clinical work was for him because he learned so much from his patients. Because obviously, it's an exchange, as you said, you don't even realize until you talk to people, you realize your own blind spots. I mean, this is a kind of an anecdote, it may not surprise you to learn from perhaps my line of questioning. I am married to a Palestinian woman. We've met fairly recently. We met about 3 years ago, and I was, until that time, I'd been interested in, I guess, the Middle East in general. I'd thought I had some sort of handle on the situation. I'd read a bit around Jewish history and the history of Israel Palestine. But obviously, my social world has significantly changed in the last 3 years through her. And I have just a totally different understanding of the situation now than I did. Than I did 3 years ago. There was no amount of book learning was kind of going to ever replace that. I mean, from to me is one of those. When I read from, I wish that some element of his humanistic wisdom could be incorporated into a solution for the region. But I also am acutely aware that on the other side, there's a, and this wasn't really clear to me before. There's a real aversion to dialogue with Jewish leftists or people precisely who present themselves as friends of the Palestinians. That the situation is so far gone that the only that and from my perspective, it's like, well, you're never going to get a solution if anti-Zionist Jews like Eric Fromm are already kind of so far beyond the pale that you can't talk to them, then there's really is no hope of a solution in the opposite direction. But equally, you have to understand, with an understanding of history and the experiences of, my wife's family and people that she grew up with, it's entirely understandable. But I just hope personally that, as I say, that it's that this strain of this of humanism that survives in Eric Fromm, that it can be translated, not just in Palestine, but I mean, if you that. Contemporary issues around, we look at the United States and some of the really deep kind of class hatreds and animosities that are coming to the fore in the last decade in the United States. One hopes that it's still possible for that strain of humanism to be audible among groups of, if you've got one person saying it and they're identified as belonging to a group which has been hostile to your group for a period of time. It's very, and I mean, in a clinical setting, I suppose there's got to be a basis of trust established before any kind of transmission of wisdom or sharing of insights can really happen. I just worry that and Fromm talks about this himself, I suppose, in his own way, but that we're almost so far gone that people can't even hear voices from the other side anymore.
Jonathan, I wonder in this context whether it might be helpful, and perhaps also in conclusion, to go back to Fromm's emphasis on human connection, right? Because I think this is very much fundamental to who he was, both in terms of a clinician, but also obviously in terms of a social philosopher and social psychologist. And how do we build solidarity with others? How do we cross divides that seem uncrossable? And certainly that is where we find ourselves in the moment. And in conclusion, I just want to read a few sentences from one of the letters that was written by one of his aunts in this case, because it's very powerful. And one finds echoes of what she writes here throughout Fromm's work on human connection and indeed love and the importance of love for others and giving freely towards others. Fromm's aunt was deported from Posen to a ghetto, a small ghetto in southeastern Poland. And eventually she was deported from there to Treblinka, where she was murdered. But from the ghetto, she was able to write a series of letters. And these letters are very powerful, in part because she's a gifted writer, but also because she describes her role as being the caretaker, indeed social worker, which is the kind of work she did prior to that point, for all the children who were living in the ghetto. And she writes the following. This is on July 13th, 1941, so already in the midst of the Holocaust. She writes, "What really lifts me up and supports me is the fact itself, that a person draws from her own deep source and joyfully gives it to others to experience. It is this power of goodness alone that I admire. I have no more admiration for cleverness, education, ability, if goodness is not there first, if goodness is not completely determinative at the center of being and everything radiates out from it. How is it possible that even with all of this so-called intelligence, civilization has not brought people even one jot further? I believe deeply in the strength of goodness and love and in its eternal and immortal power. It sustains me when I think about it that maybe my days will not be entirely pointless if only a little bit of goodness and love can radiate out from me to others, maybe to some child or a young woman, maybe to a young person who is engaging life and can carry forth this spark." And so that's just a I just wanted to give listeners just a brief sense of what is contained in some of these letters and these ideas that, again, one finds in Fromm's work later on.
Yeah, and also the fact that Fromm, this spark was transmitted to him. It wasn't something he, found on his own. That Fromm's own, education was a product of the family that nurtured and educated him, the society that out of which he, that extremely vibrant German Jewish society that was completely destroyed, ultimately in the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I really want to say thank you, Roger. I enjoyed it a great deal. Thanks for taking the time. Unfortunately, we weren't able to solve, well, I guess, too many contemporary conflicts that are kind of above our pay grade. But I did think it was important to mention them and face them as squarely as we could. Is there any kind of final? I mean, we're probably a good place to finish, to be honest. But is there anything I've missed? Is there anything from the book that you perhaps a final passage you want to that you yourself or an aspect that we've neglected that you want to leave for the listeners with?
I think we have covered so much, given the readers or sorry, listeners a sense. I think the passage about Walter Benjamin and Henny Gerland is particularly important and particularly poignant. I was able to access materials that I don't think have seen light before, to elaborate somewhat on what the circumstances were. But my primary objective was really to show the reader and to help the listener understand the degree to which Fromm and Fromm's writing were themselves a reflection of the historical trauma through which he lived and through which his family lived. And I have found since doing this research, it's quite impossible to understand Fromm's work without also thinking about Fromm's personal experience. And that was the aim in bringing this forth.
Well, yeah, I think as I've read the book with great interest, I think you've succeeded, and I hope this helps with in some small measure out also with the book's reception. And yeah, thanks so much for taking the time, and I hope to talk to you again. Maybe we can look back in a few years and on this conversation, we can do it again in 5 years and see where the world's at.
That
So
would be good.
thanks so much,
Jonathan,
Roger.
thank you. Thank
Thank
you
you.
for the invitation.
My pleasure.